Hey, deserving listeners, this is chapter 5 in our deep dive on the Duggars. Let's get into it. My name is Dr. Kirk Hanna. I'm a therapist and a professor.
My name is Umberto Castaneda, and I authorize dealers to be authorized.
So, 2005. We have reached 2005. The family has had their first special that has aired on TLC. And also, to catch you up, the family does know about Josh abusing the younger sisters and the babysitter of the younger sisters, five young girls. And they went to the police. They went to other people in the church. And they seem to be moving on with their lives, assuming that Josh won't ever do it again. And never going to a therapist and seemingly never going to CPS. So, 2005, Josh continues to defy. This is the oldest child, Josh. He's the one who abused the younger children. Josh continued to confide in Bobby Holt. Bobby is a woman. She's in the documentary, Shiny Happy People. And this is according to her, and trigger warning, by the way, because it gets a little graphic here, but I think it's important to point out that this is what she was told. That during one visit, Josh admitted to penetrating the vagina of a five-year-old girl with his finger. So up until this point, maybe it seems that what was told to the parents was that Josh had touched the girls while they were sleeping over their clothes or stuff like this. But you know, penetrating the vagina of a five-year-old girl with his finger, I mean, yikes. If it was ambiguous before, it's not anymore. And also, Josh told Bobby Holt that he had abused one of his sisters for 3 years. The sister was from the age of 2 to 5. Hard to know the frequency there, but even if it's a pretty low frequency, like once a year, that's still pretty alarming, right? And I point this out because the parents probably knew at least some of these details, if not all of them. At the very least, they should have been informed about it. But as a therapist, I've heard a lot of different sorts of things in this category where you have a sibling who has touched a younger sibling. And I've heard a lot of different accounts, things that are really quite mild. It's hard to know how the victim will feel, even if you do have a mild interaction, so to speak, a mild interaction. You could still be quite traumatized by that as a younger person, but the trauma often does coincide or does correlate with the severity and the frequency and other kinds of elements like coercion and threats and this kind of thing. But anyway, so I would hear very mild things like the initial reporting of Josh having touched one of his younger siblings over the clothes while they were sleeping. Still abusive and can be massively traumatic, but you might hear something, and it was just one instance, and it seems pretty clear that it was just one instance. All the way to, you know, extreme abuse behavior, what we're hearing from Josh, from his own mouth, is more towards the extreme, right? Ongoing.
I'm wondering, like, doesn't that seem like a cry for help that he would be confessing this to Bobby? Like, because you would think if he was like very self-aware that this is wrong and that he needs to keep it quiet because he wants to keep going, like he just wouldn't talk to anyone. It almost seems like someone needs to stop me, or I don't know. It's incredible to me that he would be sharing that with Bobby.
Yeah. I'll commend him for doing this. It's hard to know what his motivations were. You know, it's possible that Bobby Holt was just really good at extracting the information. Yeah, it's hard to know. Certainly, you can have people, and I've worked with some people like this, unfortunately, who will like to brag about it. So was that what he was doing? Was he getting off on being able to describe it? That's also possible, but it's also very possible that it was a cry for help, that he was concerned. He was young and very worried and ashamed, and because that is the normal course for this sort of thing, that people who notice these kinds of attractions, and particularly if they act on them, they're usually quite alarmed with their behavior. They look at themselves and think, oh my God, I'm one of those people. What's wrong with me? I don't want to be like this. I want to be normal. I want to be like everyone else. How come I have this urge and this desire and this attraction? I don't want this urge and attraction. That's often, it's not always the case, but that is often. So it's possible that he was saying, look, you got to know what's been happening. In fact, another criticism of the documentary, Shiny Happy People, is they didn't even go into these details. They just surface level talked about maybe one conversation between Josh and Bobby Holt. I later learned that Josh was regularly talking one-on-one with Bobby Holt about what he had done and over the span of a number of years. So it's hard to know what was going on, but I just keep thinking, if only one of the adults in this entire situation, because there were many adults, not only a police officer, but the parents, Bobby and Jim Holt, other people, I think, if only they had reached out to a treatment specialist, because even if he wasn't reaching out for help, then that treatment specialist would have been able to help. There are treatments for people like this. There are ways of managing it, obviously, but there also are ways of reorienting one's sexuality. It can be hard work, but it can work often. Sometimes it's a matter of elevating or creating the opportunity for non-abusive types of attractions while giving it enough time so that the person can get their attachment needs and sexual needs met in ways that are with peers, right? And then over time, their attraction starts to diminish towards children. They might always kind of have that in the back of their mind, but they have a venue to actually get their needs met. The problem is that unless you do something along those lines, the individual keeps acting on their urge and it will lock in that behavior. So the earlier you can intervene with these people, the better. Obviously, when they're going through puberty is a great time to intervene. Yeah. And the treatment specialists will attest to absolutely being able to help people with this. So it's just this tragedy that, and really to Josh, because eventually, long story short, spoiler alert, he ends up in prison.
It's hard enough for any family, because I think you were mentioning this before too, how it doesn't get reported, like they're afraid and stuff. And then you compound it with a lot of these cults, they don't like to deal with outside forces. They like to deal with everything internally. So I think that's what his parents were trying to do. First of all, they were trying to hook him up with an adult woman to like distract him. I don't know if she was an adult yet, but anyway, someone more of his age, right? In fact, they literally told that to his friend, the friend of the family. It's like, no, because the friend of the family is like, wait, are you trying to use my daughter to like just like pull him away? He's like, yeah, that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah, it was Bobby Holt's daughter.
And then, like, we said he went to the elders of the church, and it's like, yeah, we got to try to just like deal with it ourselves. So no idea of like, well, maybe I should reach out to a specialist, an expert, someone that can really help with this.
Right. You imagine that there's a paranoia about not only just outsiders to the cult, but also liberal therapists that will infect the minds of Josh, and we can't have that. So who knows, but quite possible. All right. So 2006, they have their second special. This is 2 years later. So a pretty slow ramp up, The first special in 2004 was very popular, but, you could be in the family and imagine that they're just like, well, okay, that was a one shot.
That was that,
right? Yeah, that's over. But then they have their second special, Raising 16 Children is what it's called.
It's been 2 years.
Right. And so, because the first special was 14 and pregnant.
Right.
And not 14 years old, but 14 children and pregnant. But now, 2 years later, it's Raising 16 Children. And they were becoming famous at this point.
It occurs to me that I'm sure they did that on purpose as a double entendre at the time when they put the first one out. Because in either case, the title would catch people's eyes. Like 14 and pregnant, people might think, someone's 14 and they're pregnant. Or in this case, no, actually, there's 14 kids.
To be clear, it's called 14 Children and Pregnant.
Never mind.
And in the same year, they have a third special, 16 Children and Moving In. So this is the episode where TLC actually paid to have their 7,000 square foot house completed.
Oh, right. Yes. Because they had been working on it like themselves with the, the children doing all the hammering and stuff. But it was, building a house is hard enough. Building a 7,000 square foot home.
Yeah, and if you've seen this house, it looks like a giant compound slash barn.
Yeah.
And it was coincidentally designed without thinking about them being on a reality TV show, but it's perfect for reality TV because it's big and yeah. it's got a big yard and lots of room for cameras and rooms for multiple children, this kind of thing. So anyway, TLC actually invested and finished the house for them. And so at this point, TLC is really locking in on this family, you know, probably
yeah.
seeing the dollar signs, right? And also TLC is starting to transition more into reality TV in general. So you just got to wonder about the executive meetings at this point. Okay, so big event happens in 2006. The police investigate Josh. This is a major thing that happens. Again, this is before they become big and household names in certain circles. They're still, this is still early. You know, that's the emphasis of like the controversy that would eventually plague the Duggars was, you know, kind of completed before they even had their own series. You know, they've yeah. only had three specials at this point. And the fact that TLC and others just forged ahead, including the family, because you got to think if you're yeah. the family, it's like, maybe we should just avoid the limelight for a while because eventually it's going to come out. But anyway,
I mean, TLC must have heard by that point, like, right? They had to have information.
It'd be dumb if they didn't have at least someone who yeah. was looking into this sort of thing, but I don't know. It's I could also see a situation where TLC, because, you know, these reality TV producers, they are on a string budget, you know. They don't, that's why they have reality TV. It's because sure. they don't want to spend money on a regular TV show. So it's possible that they just literally don't have the person power paid for to even bother looking into these things. But anyway, so Berto, do you remember a few chapters ago when I told you to remember the letter?
Yes, I was so curious. I didn't look it up because I wanted to have the big reveal.
Right. So why this was not in the documentary, I don't know. I mean, crazy.
It's a big deal.
Yeah, this letter is what starts the whole thing rolling. You know, the whole thing comes down to this letter. Okay, so to remind people, Josh tells his parents that he has been abusing the younger daughters in the family, and the parents don't know what to do, and they bring Josh to these family friends within the cult, Jim and Bobby Holt, which we've already been talking about, and they were supposed to be like spiritual leaders that are supposed to help. Josh was actually sent to a facility within the cult or recommended to do that or something, and the church actually reviewed the situation. So the church dealt with it. Jim and Bobby Holt, I think a part of the cult, were also, and they were the parents of Kaylee, who was the young girl that you were mentioning earlier, where
yeah.
they were trying to get Josh to start to court a peer and move towards marriage because they thought maybe that would fix Josh. In and of itself, that's not ill-conceived. You know, earlier I was saying part of the treatment might actually be to help them have their needs met through a relation, you know, through
yeah.
peer relationships. But in the absence of all the other elements of the treatment, then it's not likely to get rid of the problem, and it didn't. But
and by the way, also, you know, imagine you're a daughter, you know, and they're like, yeah, you should court this guy. He's awesome. He's great. He comes from this great family. Asterisk? Nope, not even an asterisk. Like, we don't know anything more about it.
Yeah.
And it's like,
right.
Shouldn't she at least be informed? I mean,
because she was blindsided. So what, and that feeling that you're identifying is what motivates the letter, I think. Anyway, so
yeah.
her name's Kaylee and is courting Josh at this point. Then the parents, Jim, Bob, and Michelle, go with, maybe they bring Josh, I'm not sure, to Jim and Bobby Holt. And they inform Jim and Bobby Holt, to their credit, Jim, Bob, and it's really kind of hard to keep these names straight because you have Jim, Bob, and Michelle Duggar, right. and then you have Jim and Bobby Holt.
Right.
Anyway, so they go to Kaylee's parents to say, hey, by the way, Josh has this problem. You know, so good on them. They could have swept it under the rug and continued with the courting process with Kaylee, but they tell Jim and Bobby Holt. Kaylee either is in the room hearing this or overhears it and is alarmed, as you're saying, like, wait,
yeah.
what? This guy that I was being groomed to marry has this problem? Yikes. And so she doesn't know what to do because she is in a cult, and I think she's in the cult, and she's isolated, so she doesn't know who to talk to, right? Which would be normal even if you weren't in a cult. I think that would be a pretty scary situation. And so she writes this letter. Kaylee writes this letter, and she's going to send it to an author that she reads books of, probably within the cult, I'm thinking, or at least a fundamentalist Christian author. And at the last minute, she decides against sending the letter, and she folds up the letter, puts it in this random book, and it goes in the family library. Well, that was a couple years earlier to this in 2000. So now we're at 2006, and the family lent the book to someone within the church on accident.
No way, dude.
Yeah.
They just lent the
book. Well, I don't think the parents knew the letter was in there.
No, of course not. They just lent the book. But what a crazy, like, I'm sure they weren't lending all their books out left and right. That's so crazy.
Yeah. Why this wasn't in the documentary, I don't know.
I mean, it's such an interesting story. I mean, the whole scenario is horrific, but as part of it, this bit is like the kind of thing you'd want to see in a movie.
This is what you would put in a fictional depiction of something like this. It has so much drama. So apparently that person finds a letter, reads it, and I think that person either told someone or went straight to the church and told people in the church, and then the information starts spreading through their church, which is in the IBLP cult, by the way. But still,
right,
not everyone in this cult is completely brainwashed into the situation. Some people were, well, regardless of what group of people you're going to inform them about something like this, you're going to see a similar breakdown in my anecdotal experience, in that some people blamed Kaylee for being a gossip. Like, oh, how dare she?
Oh my gosh, dude, that's horrible.
You know, how dare she talk about this? This is a private matter. It's all Kaylee's fault. Some people defended the Duggars and Josh, you know, hey, you know, kids do things sometimes or whatever. But some people were very alarmed by Josh's abuse of the younger kids, even though they're in this cult. They're just like, well, wait, what's going on? You know, there were some people that were more relatable, shall we say. And I think someone at the church actually decided to take action. And again, who was that person? Because the rest of this would never have happened if it wasn't for that person. Now, it could have been the person who read the letter to begin with, or it could have been someone that, who knows, but someone in the church called two different people. Number one, they called the Arkansas Child Abuse Hotline.
Finally. Oh my God. Years in the making, that call.
Yes. And provided an anonymous report, but identified Josh Duggar, right? And also, so because the Duggars were on their rise in fame, and they were really starting to hit their stride with this, they don't have their series yet, but you know, they're really starting to be famous and tabloidy, that Oprah actually invited the Duggars to come on the show.
This is the part I did know, that they were going to be on Oprah, and someone tipped Oprah off,
right,
or her team. Yeah.
So this church member knew about this, apparently, and actually called Oprah, called the production team, the show, and informed about, you know, what was in this letter. And the show received this anonymous email or letter or something outlining the abuse that Josh had committed. And the email warned the Oprah show to not have the Duggars on their show. And apparently, the Oprah team, you know, obliged and canceled the family's scheduled appearance.
Now, by the way, I found it, one thing I found odd was, like, how did they, I'm glad they did, but how did they know that they were going to be on Oprah? I wondered if, like, they had announced it at the church or something, like, hey, the Duggars are coming to Oprah or something.
Right, good point. It probably, because it's not like Oprah at the beginning of the month says, here's our schedule,
yeah,
right?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, because they hadn't even appeared yet. It's not like, because usually you would record it, and yeah, I bet you it was the Duggars themselves that shot themselves in the foot on that one.
Yeah.
And then the Oprah team forwarded the email. So not only did they cancel the appearance, but they also just forwarded the email to the Department of Human Services hotline, which is probably a similar system as the child abuse hotline would be in. And presumably the hotline then called the police. But someone eventually calls the police, but it was probably one of these hotlines. So this is what should have happened from the beginning, right?
Right.
That a proper investigation to protect the children, a proper investigation to help set up Josh with proper treatment. But so now, 2006, before they have a series, by the way, they get this opportunity.
Do we remember how old Josh was when it first started coming out to his family and things like that, that this was happening? Because, I mean, think of all those years lost and all the abuse that happened in the subsequent years. And
oh, Josh was 14.
14! My gosh, like you could have intervened into a 14-year-old's life, which is so much more malleable at that point than an adult.
So now in 2006, he's 18. He's 18 at this point. And so.
And not to mention all the abuse that could have been, potentially stopped, you know.
Yeah, that's the main thing is, that's always number one. And I went over this in a previous chapter that when I'm involved in cases like this, the number one immediate priority is to protect victims.
Yeah.
So if that means taking Josh out of the house, and that's what it means, if it means literally putting him in a side of the house, because I've done this sort of work where you actually will, I was with one family one time where this had happened, the older sibling had sexually abused the younger sibling, and we tried to figure out a solution to protect the younger child. Best case scenario, the old child would go stay with a relative that doesn't live with any, minors, but that wasn't possible. So we had the children had to stay on a floor of the house. So the older kid could only be on one of the floors and the younger kid could only be on one of the other floors. And there was a door there and the parents were always monitoring it. They were always home, that kind of thing. So that's number one. And that obviously was not done, or at least seemingly not done. I think there were reports that maybe the parents did some things, but I doubt that it was robust enough to really protect the younger kids. Anyway, so the hotline calls the police. The police investigate the family. The police interviewed the five victims, the four sisters and the babysitter. But since there's a 3-year statute of limitations, Berto,
no
fucking charges.
3 years?
Yes.
What?
Yes. It's fucking ridiculous. I mean, I get why a statute of limitations exists.
But is this for minors? Is that why? It's like,
what do you mean?
I mean, is it 3 years if you're a minor? Like, it can't be 3 years in general, right?
It might be, but every state has a different statute around these.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, I don't know how they coincide, but it's a well-understood problem that, with regular sorts of crimes, like if someone murders someone or if someone, steals your car, then it's very likely that you're going to report it pretty quickly. And the statute of limitations, it's not super intuitive to me as to why it's a good thing, but I've heard experts explain it to me as to why it's a good thing. Like the person who committed the crime, they've moved on with their life, they've changed their ways, and then all of a sudden, like 15 years later, boom, they go to prison. It doesn't make a lot of sense in that way.
Well, for some things though, like murder, there isn't a limit because sorry that you did eventually stop murdering, but you did take a life. And I think that, so maybe we don't have to have no statute of limitations, but 3 years?
But particularly with sexual abuse, because it's well understood and documented that when people are abused, they don't report it. Like I said, when someone's murdered or when someone is steals your car, there's not a barrier to reporting it. If it's worth reporting, you're going to report it. But, in general. But with sexual abuse, everyone understands, particularly if you're a child at the time, the chance of a 3-year-old reporting to anyone that they were sexually abused is, pretty much zero. And so this notion that somehow the same statute of limitations or time spans apply to these kinds of crimes is really stupid, particularly when the law is set up, presumably in part, to protect the public. And a major component of protecting the public from a criminal is to identify them and indict them and put sanctions on them, maybe prison time or maybe mandated treatment. So no one wins when, including the perpetrator who might need to be forced in treatment, when we have these, now it's changing. There are, similar to domestic violence, there's an intimate partner violence, there are problems with this, right? Because victims are terrified.
Sorry, and by the way, like the all or nothing part is also kind of silly. Like, okay, what if you do have a statute of limitations for having someone go to jail, but like, can't they still be mandated treatment or something? You know, like a range of options over time. And the other thing is, were all of the crimes older than 3 years, or we just don't know because like that's all they knew about?
Right. So that's a huge ambiguity here is, yeah. Did Josh continue to abuse? There's no evidence of that. There's no reports of that. And I could see a world in which he did manage to suppress it, or it morphed into the child porn area, which he gets into later. Hard to know. Is it possible that he continued to abuse his younger siblings? Yeah. There were very little measures taken that would assure that that wouldn't happen, right?
Yeah.
But we don't know. We definitely know it happened for a span of time prior to 14, or, you know, around the time he was 14. And once he made the reports, I haven't heard any reports of anything happening beyond that. But anyway, let's take a break. What do you say, Bruno?
Let's do it.
All right, we're back from the break. So getting back to my notes here. Yeah, so apparently, even though the police were contacted, nothing happened. I don't know if CPS was called and CPS just dropped the ball, or CPS did investigate. I didn't hear anything about that. I could imagine a situation in which the police didn't bother calling Child Protective Services. I don't know, but there's no report of CPS, Child Protective Services, getting involved. The police can do some things, but really who you want involved are ongoing caseworkers that are trained in this area. And I didn't hear any reports of that happening.
And that's what I was saying. Like, okay, so let's say that they have the stupid 3-year statute of limitations. Okay, fine. So then don't press charges, but call CPS. Like, do something that maybe can still help the family and the victims and the perpetrator, even if, fine, you're not going to press the criminal charges.
Right. And I'm glad you're bringing that up, because that is different. CPS is a different process, and there are different laws that dictate CPS's actions, and there is no statute of limitations to CPS and the laws that allow for them to take action. So you could tell CPS that your father, for example, abused you 35 years ago. And if your father, who's now, say, 7 years old, is still in contact with children, then CPS, in all likelihood, will take action to protect the children, even though the report was made 35 years later. So, I don't know, but I didn't hear any evidence that had happened. So the details of the police report, the investigation that happened in 2006, were apparently leaked to the internet. Maybe someone on the Oprah show, but who knows, someone leaked it. And message boards started to speculate about this police report or the details of it. And these message forums would grow as the Duggars gained more fame. But it was a very small group of people who were mostly being ignored as the Duggars, because that's what's so weird about, that's why I think it's important to go over the timeline, is that everything was available from the beginning.
Yeah.
Before the Duggars became, even to TLC, you could argue, right?
Right. That's what's incredible.
Right. It's one thing if you're, I don't know, Michael Jackson or something, and you become super famous, and then the reports start coming out, or Bill Cosby, and then the report. But the reports were out there and available on the internet before they started to have their major fame with their own series.
So one of the things that blew my mind the most about the story was that what little I knew, I had assumed it was like, all more recent or after the fact or whatever. And it was just like, wait, what? This already happened? Like, they knew this? What?
Yeah. And that's another part of this story that I think the documentary doesn't emphasize enough of, is at this point in 2006, you have hundreds of people that are aware of what Josh did. You have the parents and maybe some of the siblings. You have Jim and Bobby Holt. You have Kaylee. You have several church members, if not all of them. Who knows how far this rumor went. You have people on the Oprah team, maybe Oprah herself. I mean, literally, it's possible that Oprah Winfrey knew that Josh had abused the younger siblings. You have this other hotline that knows about it. You have this cop that will later go to prison for child porn himself. You have church members that are, I think, you know, upper admin sort of church members that Jim and Michelle went to initially. You have the police, a precinct that investigated this.
Yeah.
There's probably a number of detectives. Think about all the people that know about someone who is at risk, clearly, of sexually abusing. I think Josh at this point probably has like 10 younger siblings that are girls. I mean, and who knows, it's, you know, these kind of people will abuse boys too. All the children that Josh is around, and in an insular situation where all the kids are being homeschooled, for Christ's sake. I mean, you know, the kids are imprisoned with this known predator that's been predating on the siblings for years prior to the age of 14, and nothing happened, Berto.
I mean, you can't ask for a worse situation to, like, you know, if you have a wolf and sheep, it's like the wolf's living with the sheep. The wolf's already eaten several of the sheep, and there they are, and no one's doing anything about it.
Yeah. Just a complete breakdown of everything that is not supposed to break down. I mean, at least one of these systems, the police at this point, the CPS getting involved. I don't even know if they were.
This is all before the show.
Yes.
Like, that's mind-blowing. Ugh.
And I bring all this up because there are a lot of people who have been through this as victims or family members or something. And there's this myth out there that if you call the authorities, then everything will be, you know, you just have to get the authorities involved and then everything will be fine. And I know some of you listening will know that that's ridiculous. But I was disabused of this assumption early in my career when I might have even still been an intern, but I think I might have been just hired. So I would have been 26, 27, early career. And I had this teenage girl who told me that she was being sexually abused by her father. And she was hinting that she wanted to tell me something. And so I had to really work hard at making her feel comfortable and telling her, no, you know, I'm here for you. And, you know, I'm saying all these things like, I can help you with this, but I can't help you unless you tell me. So what's going on? And then, you know, several sessions in, she finally tells me that she's being sexually abused by her father. And, and I'm just, you know, it's hard to hear, but I'm there for her. And I'm just like, you did the right thing. You know, good job. And I commend you advocating for yourself. And the system is here. At this point, I'm naive. So, you know, the system is here to help you. You know, that's why it exists. And so we call CPS and CPS gets involved. And I'm like, yeah, you know, da, da, da. And they go into the home. They interview her. They interview the dad. And long story short, they do nothing.
Man.
Nothing happens. Except for now the dad knows that the daughter is now telling people. And God knows what happened. You know, it was a long time ago. I don't remember how it sort of resolved. But
was she even allowed to keep going to therapy?
I don't know. It was long, 20, you know, it was almost 30 years ago. But I don't remember it resolving well. I don't remember it resolving horrifically, but I imagine I didn't have much time left with her after that. I don't know. But that was when I learned, oh, wait, so it's not the way that people talk about it. And it's not even the way that CPS talks about it, because you talk to CPS and they'll say this, that. I will say overall, CPS workers and the system does often work. I think what happened in this case was the allegation of sexual abuse, and it was clearly sexual abuse, was not at the level that is severe enough for CPS to really fly into action. And I think they said, well, let's work with the dad. But the overall message to the daughter was, well, I'm still left on the lurch living with this guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's pretty awful. But even if we say, well, most of the time CPS works, you have all these other systems that are involved, at least in this Josh situation. Yeah. You have the police, you have church, you have parents, you have community and the internet. And yet the victims are still being victimized because we have a society that doesn't recognize how important this is, or at least they kind of do, but they don't want to do the hard work to actually fund these kinds of, you know, programs. I mean, you know, we could go down this road of just the sort of people like the Duggars that vote for politicians like the Duggars. You know, they want to dismantle all sorts of systems, including the kinds of funded systems that would be able to help situations like this. Because clearly the church and the community and sometimes even the police don't do fucking shit. So if you give CPS enough money and give them enough power and you don't hinder them through stripping away regulations and power for these institutions, then you're much more likely to see protected children instead of believing in QAnon and Tom Hanks is drinking the blood. I mean, literally, that's what people believe.
Yeah, that is one of the biggest ironies is the obsession in the last few years about child abuse, which, great, let's have that conversation. Let's go after the actual problems. Let's put up some money. How about we put up some tax funds? Oh, we don't want to tax people. Oh, I see. But here's the other thing, too. I honestly feel like as a system, that cult, but you know, in general, like the cult they were a part of, it's more important to keep the system going than individuals suffering. So if you have to have some sacrifices, and I don't even mean this like they were like, ha ha ha, well, they shall suffer, but we'll, no, I think it's kind of like how corporations with stockholders in Wall Street, they'll do some pretty evil stuff. And a lot of times the people involved either are not meaning for it to be evil or whatever. They're just like, hey, we need to make more money for the stockholders. So fine, I guess take the factory to that place that's more unethical. Here, it's like, I feel like it's similar where like, look, the big thing is we need to keep our system going, make sure we spread it, make sure we have more power. These problems, yeah, it's unfortunate, but you know, like that's not as big a deal.
Right.
Stuff happens.
Right. You can reduce it to the following flowchart. Does taking action and actually trying to protect the younger children and really seeking help from treatment specialists, you know, does addressing the problem in reality, does it actually further the power of this cult and the people in power or not? And the answer is no. To actually take action and to actually address it, you threaten the cult. You threaten the administration because, especially in this situation, because they were aware of it years prior to this.
Yeah.
And it doesn't serve them. I mean, at the very least, even if they don't think a bad thing will happen to them, there's nothing good to the organization in terms of power and money that could come from even spending the resources to really try to address this, right?
But it goes against the core messaging. Like, you follow these rules, everything's fine. Like, you follow the chain of command, you follow the, what was the name they get? Like, you're fine. The umbrellas, right? Like
the umbrellas. Yeah.
You're okay. So this goes against all of that.
Right. Like,
what do you mean? This can still happen? In fact, it can happen and get covered up? Like, what?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I guess as a, maybe a, an ancillary thing is it's potentially an indictment on having so many kids because there's less supervision and there's explicit messages to the older kids that they have to take care of the younger kids. So it could undermine that whole system, right? The older kids aren't responsible enough to take care of the younger, you know, anyway.
Yeah.
So around this time, you know, so just the whole, to wrap this up, nothing happens. Oprah Winfrey's team finds out about it, you know, that letter, but the one thing that happens is the internet now knows, which that grows over time. This same year, 2006, Jim Bob sought the Republican nomination for the Arkansas State Senate, and he lost again. He has lost a number of political runs, you know, for federal Senate, this sort of thing. But with that, Berto, let's go to 2007. But the rest of this episode is just going to be for patrons of the podcast. So if you want to hear the rest of this discussion, become a patron, go to patreon.com. Otherwise, everyone, please take care of yourself because
you deserve it.
All right, we're in the patron zone. Patrons, any special message, Berto, you want to give the patrons right now?
Absolutely. 5,000 years ago, we started a journey, and you all know it. We've been working towards our goal. It takes a lot of money, but with your support, we're almost there. So keep it up. Almost there.
Okay, 2007, there are more specials. They still don't have a regular series. On the Road with 16 Children and then Raising 16 Children, etc.
Wait, what was the On the Road bit? Did they go on like literally a road trip?
I think they got a giant like bus or something. Yeah,
RV. Yeah, that would have to be like a team bus. Like, can't just be a normal home, mobile home.
Yeah, I think it might have been two birds with one stone because they were going around to the various different IBLP member churches and talking about their parenting and their wonderful family and that sort of thing.
Right.
Getting the word out, that kind of stuff, I think. So Jim, Bob, and Michelle were becoming more and more famous. They hosted parenting seminars across the country, and that might have been another part of that hitting the road. So they're starting to make probably a lot of money at this point, being hired to speak, right? An internet user who went by the name of Alice wrote a lengthy blog comment outlining sexual abuse within the family. So at this point, the small internet community is paying attention to the leaked police report. Now, I don't know if it was the actual report or it was just a summary of the report, but you know, there are people online going, wait a second. And then this person named Alice comes forward and actually gives a lot more detail to what Josh has been doing. Who do you think that could have been, Berto, that Alice character?
I think that could have been the person that found the letter or someone associated with them.
Right. Or even Kaylee herself, the one who wrote the letter to begin with.
The only thing is like, potentially. Yeah, could be.
Hard to know. But
it seems pretty bold to do, though, right? Like, even though you're using probably a false name and stuff, like just to put it out there, it takes a lot of guts in a way.
Well, who knows what the background of this person is? There's a possibility that person was a victim themselves by someone else's abuse and wants to do something about it. Who knows?
Yeah.
But it's also, I would assume this is the moral thing to do within the church. You know, if you're really following the teachings of the church, then obviously you care about children and their welfare. And it would be very hard to fall asleep at night knowing that you're not doing something about it.
Right.
That's always the irony of these kinds of things, that for these cult Christians or cult, really any religion, especially Christians, because it's so much based on poverty and charity and loving people regardless. Yet, you know, LGBTQ people deserve no rights at all. You know what I mean? It's just like,
Well, the other thing that's crazy is that we have, we have the folks in the church teaching that even talking to a member of the opposite sex in a room unsupervised is terrible. You should never do it. You certainly can't like flirt or you showing too much skin, horrible. Touching, okay, now you're out of the church. Like, forget about it. Well, here you have like ridiculous times 100.
Right.
We don't care?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of sin and transgression, let's say Josh had kissed a girl.
That's a
huge deal, right?
Man. We might have to kick you out of the church. No, forget about it. Like, out of here. That's those two dudes that I was watching.
Right, so that's pretty a big deal in their world. And then you have not only penetrating, penetrating a 2-year-old. Do you know what I mean? You would think that would be the biggest crime of all, but somehow it's all like, swept under the rug.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah. So 2008, they got their TV series finally, 17 Kids and Counting. It aired from 2008 to 2015. It was, you know, taken off the air because of things that happened later.
7 years.
Yeah.
That's incredible, right?
Like, What do you mean?
All this has happened. Nothing is being done. They start the series and it runs for 7 years.
Right. Yeah. And meanwhile, those people on the internet are starting to talk more and more, right? As the show gains more and more notoriety, particularly because the first season is heavily focused on Josh and particularly his courtship with Anna, who he's still married today. So this season, this very first season, was about their courtship and about how great Josh was. Michelle said, saving that first kiss for your, this is on the show, the mom, Michelle, saving that first kiss for your wedding day is like really special. And I hope that it inspires others to consider that as well. End of quote. So, you know, this is knowing what Josh has already done, right? how in the world do you sleep at night if you're the parents, if you're anyone working on this show, even halfway knowing what's been happening? I mean, where's the shame? You would think that the parents would be like, eh, for our own reasons, we don't want to focus on Josh. So let's focus on the other kids.
Well, because that... this is what shows the...
This is why it's so egregious to people who knew what was going on and people in recent years. Because, and this is why, Berto, everyone was asking us to cover this story for many years. Because it's not just that there was one kid in this family that was doing this. It was arguably the star child, right? The firstborn child. And what he eventually would become, not only just on the show, but in the political world, you know?
Yeah.
And everyone's just sweeping it under the rug.
Well, so this is part of the thing I feel is that for the parents, this was their baby because they actually were the parents. At the time, they didn't have all the other children to be parenting Josh. They were the parents. That was their baby.
Right.
And I felt this, I mentioned this in one of the earlier episodes, that like I felt that from the mom like and the dad, like they probably didn't have as strong of a connection to some of the latter children, right? And so Josh is still their baby boy.
Yeah, absolutely. You could imagine for the parents after 17 kids, it'd be hard to remember the names of the younger kids, right? But you probably always remember the first few kids. Anyway, so, Berto, there's a big question, and this is kind of a tangent, but it's relevant to the story. The question to you is it ethical to involve children in reality television? Because that's what's happening right here. You know, we kind of take it as just like, well, that's what happens. You know, it's a reality TV show about a family with kids. What are you going to do? But I think we should just be asking that fundamental question. Is it ethical to do that at all? What do you think, Berto?
It's a great question, man. I think the answer lies closer to the no. My kids were a lot younger when they were little, especially the first one. You know, most parents think their kids are adorable, and so I did too. And I seriously thought, you know, like, oh man, I should make like little videos of all these cute things this kid is doing and putting. And I ultimately decided not to. I obviously made videos and shared them with my family. I used to put some on Facebook, but I decided never to put one out in the real world like YouTube. And then my second kid.
Why did you decide?
Well, because I felt like it's not something, it's not fair to them because like, they're not, even if I asked like a little 3-year-old, like, hey, do you want me to do this? And they said, yes, that's not really, they don't understand what that means. Putting their content out there. And by the way, this is years ago, knowing now what I know, like, forget about it. Like, I basically got lucky back then that somehow my inner intuition was afraid of things that I actually didn't know I should have been afraid of later. Things like people actually using those videos for really bad purposes, but let alone getting bullied or later getting, you know, harassed or any number of things. Them having zero control about the fact that their life is on display for who knows how many people, and it can never be taken out. Like, you know, once it's up there, you can never really eliminate it. I just didn't feel like that was okay.
Yeah, well, good for you. I mean, I don't think very many parents, even today, think about that. So that's interesting. And I see this as being in line with other principles that you follow. Like, you're also very adamant about not using pirated material, right? Because, you know, there was a time, the Napster, Kazaa years, where it eventually, even people who are pretty moral individuals were regularly using Napster to get songs and music and that kind of thing.
I got in so many arguments with my friends over this. Yeah.
What do you mean? Tell me.
Oh my gosh, I won't name names, but basically at the time.
Because you were ground zero, you know, in that situation.
At the time, I would get on these moral high ground arguments with them all the time where I was like, but you're not paying for this music. And they were like, oh, you don't know how many CDs I've bought. Like, I deserve this. I'm like, you haven't paid for this. I was not only the last man standing, I never went down that route. I never did.
Did you know anyone else who followed that principle?
I don't know. I was the idiot.
Out of probably like hundreds of people that you would...
I was always ridiculed for it. Like, you... And mostly because the thought was literally like, first of all, is an unstoppable force at that point. And also, there was this justification of like, look, I've spent a lot of money in music in my life. I don't see why I need... I had spent a ton of money on music. I still spend a ton of money on subscriptions. I just, as an artist, as a musician, I was always like, well, that sucks. I don't want... If someone's going to enjoy my music, great. If I gave it to them for free, great. If I put out a CD and I hope people will pay for it, it sucks if everyone just like got it for free.
Yeah.
I want my coin.
Yeah. And then Torrent comes out and you could get a lot more than music or...
Yeah, all the movies, everything.
Right. And so you have that principle, and I could imagine that skepticism about the trends of modern internet culture was already there for you, and you're just thinking,
It's probably related. Yeah. Yeah, and maybe it's because I thought that, like, as a child, one of the things that I do remember my dad doing with me is having conversations about, like, as an example. So I would participate in all these competitions, like math competitions, computer competitions. And I do remember my dad asking me, like, is this something you want to do? Do you want to continue? He was also pushing me on it too, but I do remember him asking me. And I was older, you know, I wasn't a little 3-year-old. I was probably at least 11 or 12 or something. Now, I do feel that kids at some age, and I don't know what the right age is, maybe can give consent and say, okay, well, maybe that is 12, maybe that's 15. I don't know what the right age is. I just think that in general, there should be some limit to this. Like, you can't just slap little babies and kids without their consent or even understanding what it means and have the whole world see their lives forever.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And what you're talking about is just posting a short, cute video of your kids on Facebook or something, and it probably not having a likelihood of causing a problem. You know, it's not like you're filming your daughter as, and this is literally, there are literal cases like this, which we'll get into, where she just menstruated for the first time. You just shove a camera in her face and you ask
her. Yeah, I remember some of this. I remember some scandals like this.
Yeah. So you're not even talking about that. You're just talking about just she's playing with blocks and she says a funny thing and you're just like, that was cute.
Yeah.
You're just saying like, look, you know, because to me, the question is, do we need to post children on the internet? Is there some kind of need there? And, you know, the risk is probably low for a lot of kids to have been negatively impacted by it. But we always have to think about cost versus benefit. So what's the benefit? Does it justify taking that risk? And the answer is no. And especially when you consider what parents and other and reality TV shows will actually publish, you know, it's again, right. It's not just a kid saying a joke. It's pretty severe kinds of things. Like we were talking in the previous chapter about that kid who had the seizure. And then you have the other older kid who is panicking, taking care of the younger kid. Do both of those kids want that whole scene to constantly reviewed and forever available to the entire world?
Right. Because there's a huge difference between, and look, it's I have nothing against parents and stuff that like their kid was talking to the dog and the dog fell on its head and the kid tumbled down with a ball. Hilarious. Post a video up, get a lot of views, fine. I personally, I decided not even to go that route, but I honestly, I don't think that's that big of a deal. I love those kind of cute videos, but there's a big difference between like a one-off video like that to I'm going to document your life or very delicate parts of your life without your understanding of what that means, let alone your consent. And I'm going to put it out there and for my financial gain. Because really, like the thing is like, I'm going to create a YouTube video because I'm going to use my kids to make money.
Yeah. And I'll get into it because I'm going to go into all the laws in a second. But the conclusion that I've come to is when you allow for some wiggle room there, you know, if you're just like, well, like what you're saying, it's like, look, if you want to post this kind of content, that's fine. But there's a line. We understand if you just say that to the general public, that people aren't going to know the line very well or they're going to abuse the line.
Yeah.
So to me, my position is let's just stop it. Let's just stop the whole thing until the person is old enough like you're saying, maybe when they're a teenager. But even then, we didn't have that when we were kids, and we survived. You know, when we were 17, we couldn't go on Twitter, we couldn't post on YouTube, and we lived. So you don't have to have it, and there's so much risk to it. Even if the 17-year-old is saying, yes, I do want this out there, there's a huge risk to the child incurring some major consequences. Like I said, do we need to have that out there? Does a 17-year-old need to post things on the internet? And I would argue no. So, you know, and there are a lot of kids, a lot of teens who make their own content and post it and think, yay, look at me. And then, you know, 10 years later, they are being canceled because they ended up outing themselves as being a racist at the time. And they've grown since then. You know what I mean? Like, totally. There's just a lot of negative consequences to having this sort of thing.
So it occurs to me, like, we already have kid actors, and that's already a problem, right? Like, there's a lot of times that they get abused. But even let's say that they don't get abused behind the scenes, there have been many stories where they play a role that, like, remember Joffrey? Like, there's a lot of cases where kids play roles that then they get bullied about or they get hated about and stuff. But that's already a thing, and that's already something that probably needs more regulation and whatnot. But then there's this other dimension, which is when you're posting about your real life, it's no longer a character you're playing, which I think definitely adds an extra problem to the equation.
Completely, completely. So yeah. Let's get into it. So this is going to be a long section on child labor laws in general and entertainment laws and this sort of thing. And I'm not an expert, but I did spend a fair amount of time rabbit holing and deep diving into the laws. And so let's get into it. So let's start, Berto, with general child labor laws in general. So kids working in factories or reality TV, just the whole thing about a minor working. Right. And so children have always worked in our species. They worked on farms, and it was by necessity. Families would literally have more children so they could have more labor to survive on the farm. Work by teen boys was particularly profitable for families, which I find to be interesting, that when they look at the economics of child labor, they found that the amount of money per hour that you could estimate that families could get from having a teenage boy, say 300 years ago or even today in some communities, right? It was a lot of money. Teenage girls couldn't make as much money, I think due to muscle power, essentially. You know, a lot of farming is and livestock, you know, taking care of livestock, it's a lot of muscle power and endurance. And so teenage boys had the most bang for your buck. And so you could argue that's where at least some of our sexism comes from, right? And how families would be trying to get rid of their daughters to other families. You'd literally have to pay another family to take a daughter because of the economics of she's not going to be able to work as efficiently in the things that actually make money for the family, you know, at least in general. And so people have known about this, and it's been just a normal part of life that as soon as you're able, you start working on the family farm. And it was seen as bad parenting actually not to have your children work long hours. There's evidence of, you know, a couple hundred years ago in the United States, back in my day, I worked 12 hours a day, and, you know, kids today, they only work 8 hours a day. What's wrong with kids today? And this is why there was a lot of pushback on school and education, because they were learning how to be soft and this kind of thing. And so it's really quite normal in a lot of cultural times and pockets around the world that children work. And it's a problem, obviously, because in all likelihood, our species in the distant past, before civilization, before agriculture, it's quite likely that children didn't work and they didn't need to work as much as they did with agriculture and industrialization. Anyway, so
they probably couldn't hunt very well compared to, I mean, certainly if they were 15, but like a 10-year-old would get killed probably instantly by a tiger.
Yeah, and the sort of work, who knows, but was probably a lot more palatable. Like if you're five, you might be walking alongside mom as she's gathering berries from a nearby pasture, and you're just in the field, casually gathering berries at times too. You know, it's not like working in a coal mine, which, you know, is eventually what happens. Mm.
Yeah.
So fast forward to early 1800s when industrialization starts to come into full swing in Europe, Western Europe, United States, and children started working in factories at this point, and they were really horrific working conditions. So you already have a culture where, yeah, children work, and the work on the farm was not great, but it wasn't like working in a factory.
Right.
And then, so then you have industrialization, you have a lot of people moving away from the farms into cities, and that tradition just continues. And so you have 5-year-olds that are going into factories and working in very unsafe environments where children are breaking limbs or falling into a vat of oil or something. And it was, an alarming situation. So in 1842, the Massachusetts Factory Act was passed in 1842. This is one of the first laws regulating child labor. And it was pretty complicated, but to summarize, children under 12 years old working in manufacturing establishments couldn't work more than 10 hours a day, Berto.
Wow, how generous.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like,
so if you're,
don't worry,
if you're,
your children are safe now.
Yeah.
So if you're 10 hours.
If you're 12, you can work 13 hours a day.
Right.
But if you're 12 and younger, you can only work 10 hours
a day. Yeah. It's so much better. Oh, wow.
But that just tells you the extent to the labor problems, you know, and the child abuse at this point.
Oh, God.
So then you fast forward to 1938. So this is almost 100 years later. And there were other child labor laws that were passed along the way, but not great. So you have a pretty major federal act in 1938 in the United States called the Fair Labor Standards Act. And it had, I believe, a lot of regulation and rules for everyone of all ages, including children, but it's a major step forward for protecting children with the goal of reducing harm to children, increasing education and safety and health, meaning that they were saying, hey, kids deserve to be educated. And if working interferes with education, education needs to take priority. This act of 1938 was revised many times. It was, you know, furthered as our society legislated moving forward. Then we fast forward, although it's a pretty complicated story, but then we fast forward to today in 2023, and a couple years ago, really, and you see states like Arkansas, Iowa, New Hampshire, and New Jersey are actually rolling back protections that have been established. Do you know why they did this, Berto? You heard about these stories, right?
Yeah, I heard that. I don't know the reason other than...
What do you imagine the reason being?
I'm imagining that corporations donated money to these politicians so that they could get more labor for cheaper.
Could be.
I don't know.
That's not the stated reason. You know, what do you think the stated reason would be?
Let's see. What Orwellian stated reason could be?
The arc of history bends towards justice. Yeah. So if anything, you would think every step of the way, whenever there's a change in child labor laws, that it would be more restrictive and more protective. But somehow in recent years, we've been going backwards.
Usually the way these things go is it's stated in a way that's the complete opposite of what's the reality. So it'd be something like, we need to protect the children because right now they are very limited things they can do and they can't earn money. And so we're actually going to give them more options, more choice, more something like that.
Yeah, maybe. But the main stated reason, and it took me a while to actually figure this out because the reporting was pretty black and white about it, but the stated reason by the politicians who advocated and eventually passed these laws were in response to the labor shortages during the pandemic.
Oh, I see. Right. Oh, I love it. It's like, we're going to dynamically respond to the need we have in the workplace to bring more workforce. And we're going to expand to new audiences, powerful audiences.
Right. Instead of addressing the systemic problem, which is well understood by experts and economists, that when you don't have an appropriate wage for people, then they have not as much incentive to work, right? And you have, like in Seattle, rising housing prices, so people have to flee and are, you know, gentrified out of the area. They literally can't, it's uneconomic for them to commute to Seattle to work, you know? And Seattle has one of the highest minimum wages in the world. Ours is $15, sometimes more, depending. There are other places in the country where I think minimum wage is still like in the sevens or something.
Jeez. $7. I mean, I was making $7. It wasn't minimum wage, but I was making $7 my first summer after high school, which is eons ago, like centuries. We go back to the dinosaurs.
Right. You also don't raise taxes enough to pay federal employees, this kind of thing. Like, if you actually raise the incentive, i.e. the pay, of these jobs, then you would probably get a lot more people willing to make the sacrifice to work, and thus you wouldn't have to exploit child labor in the process. You know what I mean? Yeah, it's really upsetting. It's like, we can no longer exploit the poor, so we have to switch to a different group, which is the children.
The children.
What a wonderful system. Yeah, so specifically in these new rolling back laws, they're lowering the age that children could work.
To what?
It depends, you know, it's state by state. That's one thing I learned during this deep dive, Berto, is like every state has like a different standard, so the changes are different. And also every state has like kind of a different history on these rules. So it's really hard to summarize the American law system. Anyway, but generally speaking, they're lowering the age that children could work, increasing the maximum hours that age groups can, because, you know, typically the laws are such that, you know, at this age you can work this amount, and at this age you can work more.
Was there something like that in Washington? Because I don't remember a limitation on hours once I was able to work.
Yeah, you know. I mean, past a certain age, like maybe 16 or something, you can work full time.
Was there an interim? I don't remember an interim.
No, there's always been laws. Yeah, there's always in Washington State. Yeah. I mean, in our lifetime.
Yeah, I mean, I remember like I couldn't work for McDonald's before I was like 15 or something. But once I could work, I don't remember them saying, oh, you're out of hours that you can work this week. You know,
you probably could have worked for McDonald's prior to 15, but the hours would have been so minimal that McDonald's wouldn't bother hiring you.
Okay.
Yeah. Or maybe there are laws about kids of a certain age working in a dangerous kitchen, or I don't know. But there's always been those laws. And also, these laws make it harder to sue an employer for children being injured on the job, Berto.
Oh, great. See, always protect the companies, not the individuals.
Yeah. I mean, okay, if you're really worried about labor and shortages, and you really don't want to address the underlying systemic problem, and you want to continue making the rich to get richer, okay, you lower the age, you increase the max hours, okay. But then you make it harder to sue an employer for children being injured on the job. I mean, how cynical and evil. I mean, if you presented that to in a fictional story about a comedy, it was a comedic movie like Zoolander or something. And
no, I know this is a Christmas movie where the bad guy is proposing this, and all of us audience members go like, "Oh, that's ridiculous! Oh, this is funny that it's so ridiculous."
Yeah, there's a whole swath of Americans that just are in this echo chamber and just gleefully vote these people into office and support everything they do.
Younger workers and with more risk and fewer options once that risk.
Meanwhile, QAnon is going to
save
the children from the reptile people. Like,
well, we got to save them from the reptiles so they can show up to work and get injured.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, well, let's adjourn there. And in the next chapter, chapter 6, we'll start with going into more of the laws, which there's a lot of detail there. So until next time, patrons, thank you so much for being patrons. And please take care of yourself, truly, because
you deserve it.